Hartley. I am not Darren Weeks. I'm Jackie Patru, standing in for Darren tonight. I called earlier and left a message and asked, but I guess he wasn't available. Darren does his own music, and on Wednesdays when we do the original Sweet Liberty broadcast, the Sweet Liberty theme song is always on, and so I am assuming that we are on the air. It's a little disconcerting when it just goes dead like that. Anyway, Darren is involved in a project right now, and I offered to take this for him to give him, loosen up a little, free a little bit of his time, because he's going in 20 different directions at once. Darren has a full-time job and probably doesn't talk about how overwhelmed he is with all that he's involved in, but he does have a full-time job. His wife works, and they have their daughters. And so besides that, he does his broadcast Monday and Tuesday night. And besides that, he maintains the Sweet Liberty. He built and has been maintaining the Sweet Liberty website, I guess, maybe since 97, 98. I don't know. And, of course, he has his own website, darrenweeks.net, I think it is. So he's a busy person. And so I'm here tonight in his place. I wanted to let you know, in case that you may be newer listeners, Carl Klang was the person that you heard singing that song. Actually, it was a song, Taking the Patriots Away. And I don't know if he has a website or not. I used to play Carl Klang a lot, just for a little break when I was on shortwave for 4 hours a week, and I always said that he was my favorite songster, and I haven't changed my mind about it. Some of his songs are just awesome. One of my favorites was America, Is It Too Late to Save You? It's a beautiful song. But he's, in case any of you would be interested in checking it out, you might check and see Carl Klang with a K to see if he might have a website and how you could maybe get his audio tapes if you were interested. Today is Monday. It's the first day of August in the year 2006. And our spiritual message this evening, I use the quotes often from the Course in Miracles, from the text and the workbook and the teacher's manual. It is said that, in fact, Alan says that A Course in Miracles is New Age. Maybe it is. I don't know. And the thing that we have to be careful of, folks, you know, the truth is hidden in plain sight. There is truth in the Bible, even though we know that that was compiled by man and tampered with and twisted and torqued, and it's full of inconsistencies. There is also truth there. And the truth for me are some of the statements attributed to Jesus, the one we know as Jesus. So in A Course in Miracles, I couldn't say it is or isn't New Age. But you want to be careful to, how would you call, pigeonhole anybody who doesn't embrace the brand name religions, who has studied and read and searched for truth and through experiences, have literally experienced the truths that have been hidden from us, the truth about the power of the mind and the power that resides within each and every one of us. And because sometimes something is said that is similar or maybe sounds the same as some, quote, New Age statement, you want to be careful not to paint everybody with the same brush. I am not New Age. I want you to know that. I don't know anything about the New Age movement, except I do remember reading a book. I have a book here on the early Freemasons and all the secret societies. And you know, I haven't been able to put my fingers on that book again, but when I got towards the end of this book, I remember making notes at the side of it and highlighting and brackets around it. They created the New Age movement. And so I could see that that was all part of just, they've got something for everybody, basically what it is. However, I attended on a weekly basis. Once a week we would get together. It was a Course in Miracles study group, and there is truth in a Course in Miracles. I want you to know that. I want you to know that. I know that. I don't believe it. I know it. And this is what I'm going to share with you is the introduction to the text of A Course in Miracles. And by the way, I was contacted by a woman who happened to have been a student at the School of Metaphysics. I think it was Kansas City, Missouri, or Kansas. I was a student of the School of Metaphysics in St. Louis, Missouri, St. John, Missouri. And she happened to find me through hearing Alan. I might have been on George Noory. And she wrote me, and she said the more she heard me, the more she saw that we had in common. And she said that the Course in Miracles, there evidently the book had, or the books, because there's three of them, had gone through some type of a court battle. And evidently it's been edited quite a bit. So like anything else, I would imagine if there the much of the truth that is in the Course in Miracles may have already been twisted and torqued. I don't know. But I'm reading to you the introduction. It's very short, and it's very beautiful. It says, this is A Course in Miracles. A miracle is defined, by the way, as an expression of love between brothers. And they said that all miracles are maximal. In other words, there aren't any big or little miracles. In other words, if smiling at a stranger as you pass them on the street, giving a friend aspirin if they have a headache, lifting a car off a child, those are all expressions of love, and every miracle is maximal. And I like that. I like that thought. The introduction, this is A Course in Miracles. It is a required course. Only the time you take it is voluntary. Free will does not mean that you can establish the curriculum. It means only that you can elect what you want to take at a given time. The course, listen to this, folks, the course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence. Do you like that? Which is your natural inheritance. The opposite of love is fear. But what is all-encompassing can have no opposite. This course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way. Two lines, folks. Nothing real can be threatened, and nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. I wanted to share that with you tonight. And I don't have a guest with us. And so what I'm going to do, I have been reading a book. I guess I've been reading this book for months. It's titled God's Genes and Consciousness. I had this mailed to me, and it looked like it came right from the publisher. There was no note with it or anything, and no bill, you know, like you owe us $30 or $20 or whatever. And the subtitle to this, God's Genes and Consciousness, is Non-Human Intervention in Human History. The author of the book is Paul Von Ward. He's a professor. I'm not saying that you should believe what I'm going to share with you tonight, but I will tell you this. One of the reasons I've been wanting to share this with you, I've picked the book up, I've read part of it, and then lay it down and pick another book up, and three or four books later I pick it back up again. What I found myself doing is rereading, though, because this book is packed. Nothing I have ever read, and nothing anybody has ever said, has ever said or explained where all the different colors and races of people came from in this world. And that has always been an intriguing question in my mind, and it doesn't let go. It's never gone away, and it's never been explained to me, not in any way that ever made any sense. I read Zachariah Sitchin's works. They made sense. And when I very first heard about him, the friend that told me about his books, I thought, oh my goodness, she's really lost it. And she said, oh, I really needed to read these books, and I didn't. And then when Chuck and I were moving up to Pennsylvania here, I had dinner with a friend, and he did this little speech before he gave me the book. He said, it sounds crazy, but he said, if you read the book, it does make sense. And he gave me the first of Zachariah Sitchin's books called The 12th Planet. And what it did when I read it, it explained a lot of the questions I had when I was 15 years old. As many of you have heard me say, I decided I wanted to know what was in the Old Testament. Being brought up in the Lutheran Church, excuse me. Well, all of the ministers' sermons, the pastor's sermons, and everything was focused in the New Testament. Of course, I'm sure that the Lutheran churches are different today. As I have said many times, I have been a seeker of truth throughout my life, and the truth I was seeking was not truth about our physical history in this world, but spiritual truth. And so I got curious about what was in the Old Testament. And so that was my nighttime reading for a while. And as I've said before, it frightened me. I am a vengeful God or a jealous God, and I will bring my wrath down upon the generations. When I used to lay in bed at night as a little girl, talking to God and asking God a jillion questions, because I was always a night owl from my very earliest memories, I was not having conversations because I didn't hear the voice coming back at me, but I was communicating with a loving creator, and I knew that in my heart. I was never, quote, afraid of God, of creator. I always wondered about when they would say, oh, he's a God-fearing person. Jesus told us to love our Father Creator with all our heart, mind, strength, and soul, and love our neighbor as ourself. He didn't say anything about fearing God. But in the Old Testament, I got scared, and especially when I read that statement by Jehovah, because I thought, oh my, does this mean anything I do wrong, my children are going to pay for it? I am a jealous God. And as I read the book, the Old Testament, the questions that I had as a 15-year-old girl, one of them was, why would God want all these wars? There were so many wars throughout the Old Testament. And then, of course, right in the get-go, I thought the story of creation was beautiful in the beginning. And I thought it was so beautiful that I actually memorized that first part of it. But then when God said, let us make man in our image, naturally, that was the first question. Who's he talking to? And when Adam and Eve were in the garden and they got scared because they ate of the tree of fruit of knowledge of good and evil, and they were hiding, and it told about God walking through the garden looking for Adam, and I knew our creator. I used the word God at the time in my mind, so when I say our creator, that wasn't what I said, but there have been so many gods, thousands and thousands of gods, and it's a word that doesn't really mean that much to me anymore. I knew that our creator didn't have to go looking for anybody, because I understood, I knew that that was omnipotent, omniscient, ever-present, all-knowing. And that was a question in my mind. And then the story about when the Lord and his angel were on the way to Sodom and Gomorrah to check out the rumors the Lord had been hearing about Sodom and Gomorrah. There's Abraham sitting at his tent, and they're walking by, and he invited them to come in and have something to eat and rest themselves. Now, you see, what this does is it puts a human, totally human qualities on our Creator. Our Creator, our Father Creator, is Spirit, and we are of and are that Spirit of, one with that Spirit. So this is all very confusing to me. And so the Lord God told Adam, or told Abraham, that he was on his way to check out the rumors he was hearing. And that, again, of course, sounded real stupid to me. And then the next thing you know, Abraham is negotiating with him, because, quote, God was going to kill everybody. And Abraham said, well, what if we could find 50 people? Could we save them out? Well, okay, fine. And then he kept getting him down. I was going to say chewing him down. He kept talking him down till finally he said, well, what if we can find one? And so there you are, you know, negotiating and bargaining with God. And so finally that was fine. Then you have the story there about Lot sitting at the gate when the angels of the Lord came. And it wasn't the Lord God himself. The angels of the Lord came, and Lot told them, you better come in, it's getting dark. They said, no, we're here to check out. We have to stay out here because we're here to check out the rumors and report back. And finally, Lot talked them into coming in. And then the people in the town came and said, hey, Lot, who are those people? Who are those men in there? Bring them out here. We want to know them. And Lot comes out, he brings his virgin daughter out, and he says, hey, leave them alone, they're my guests. Here's my virgin daughter. You can do with her what you will, but please leave my guests alone. Well, they wanted to see those men, and I know there have been Christians who have said that when they said they wanted to know them, meant they wanted to have sex with them. Might be so, it might be not. Point is, they tried to reach into the house, I guess. And anyway, the angels of the Lord came out and smote them blind with their, what, laser guns? These all stuck in my head all of those years from the time I was 15 years old. And when I read Zechariah Sitchin's 12th Planet, it explained the possibility. I'm not saying it is. I said the possibility that there have been visitors to this planet Earth, and whether they were extraplanetary or extra-dimensional, I don't know. I don't know if anything that Zechariah Sitchin wrote is true. Allegedly, his books were taken, translated from the old Sumerian cuneiform text. And as I was reading the books, I was remembering in my mind those, and I thought, oh, okay, that's who he was talking to. It was Enlil and Enki talking. The point is, there's probably truth in there, too. I found out that Zechariah Sitchin, because I have one hardcover book of his, and I had never read anything about him, he matriculated at the London School of Economics. Now, that's an elite school. And Cy said, oh, man, okay, so there's hooks in these books, too. And I suppose there are hooks in every book that we read. I know I'm taking a long time to get to this. I said I was going to read to you some excerpts of this book tonight. But anyway, I am not convinced that this planet hasn't been visited. That's what I'm saying. And the Paul Ward, the author here, does use Zechariah Sitchin. Not all. his bibliography, it just goes on and on and on. In fact, I thought about maybe getting a hold of this guy and seeing if he would like to come on with us, because every single chapter, he's got footnotes, and there's probably, actually, they're postscripts, he calls them, and there's about 25 pages for each chapter, all of the end notes, and then he's got suggested reading here. There's about 5, 6, 8 pages of suggested reading. So anyway, I'm enjoying the book. I have enjoyed reading it because it gives me at least something to consider. And see, here's another thing I wanted to mention to you. This planet Nibiru, from Zachariah Sitchin's works, allegedly the planet makes a very long elliptical circuit around, and so it takes something like 3,400 years, and allegedly, according to Sitchin in the Sumerian text, his translation of it, when the planet was here, and evidently this happened over and over every 3,400 or 3,600 years, but as it would come close to the Earth, they had their spaceships that they could land on planet Earth, and they could go back and forth from their planet Nibiru to the planet Earth as it was making its slow transition, because it was fairly close to the Earth at one end and then goes way out and then back again. Now, the reason that had a ring of truth to me, because the astrological chart, the wheel, has 12 houses in it, and it uses the 9 planets and the sun and the moon. So that's only 11. And I always wondered about that. And I can remember reading once, I'm not an astrologer either, and I know that there is, astrology is what they call a pseudoscience, and it's nothing evil about it. Anybody who has ever had a natal chart run by a good astrologer, then you would know that there is something to astrology. And that's probably why the Old Testament says you're not supposed to use it. Because basically what it does is it just lays out that the exact time of your birth and place of your birth, where the other planets were, what their energy is, and how it can affect you. And that's all there is to it. But I remember reading this at one time. Well, it said Taurus does not have a planet. However, because each of the sun signs has a planet, Libra is Venus, and that I'm Libra. But anyway, it said when I was reading this, Taurus doesn't have a planet, but it will return. And so in the meantime, when they run a chart on Taurus, Taurus borrows the planet Venus from Libra. And so when I read this about the 12th planet, I went back in my mind and I said, I wonder if that's so. I wonder if that is so, that why would they have the 12 signs there and only 11 planets to account for it? And that was another reason there was a ring of some truth in this for me. And folks, once again, I'm not sitting here saying, oh, no, this is so. I do not know it so. However, I do not believe that there's anybody who can say they absolutely know that this planet has not been visited by other planetary beings or maybe other dimensional beings. And if they say they know it, they have to say how they know it, don't they? And so anyway, in the beginning of this book, he's going back to the different ancient civilizations and to the different areas in the world, and talking about each of their, quote, religious beliefs. And they all had gods. And their gods walked with them and talked with them. And they're, I mean, it's just almost every ancient religion. And they say that, well, their God taught them astronomy and their God taught them agriculture. And so he goes through this and he, and then he gets into part two here. Wait, I had a place I wanted to read, I think, before I went there. Maybe not. Excuse me. I got to reading this tonight to see where I wanted to start. Listen to this. He says, whether one believes any particular conspiracy theory or not, a majority of citizens have come to the view that officials often conspire to obscure or fudge the facts about things that would endanger their particular agendas. As for the issues of ABs, he calls them ABs, short for advanced beings. As for the issue of ABs, I believe a crisis of public confidence is brewing. It is almost as if a state of collective schizophrenia were emerging, where, quote, official reality is incongruent with the lived experiences of large groups of citizens. Private groups increasingly call for recognition of the obvious activities of unknown craft and alien beings and their intercommunication with humans. The more they seek attention, the stronger the resistance of the government and scientific and religious institutions to admit the existence of any evidence. Still another factor adds to the complexity. Now listen to this. Beyond denying the three-dimensional existence of advanced beings, a powerful elite appears to want to keep ordinary individuals from learning to use innate inner senses to discover how they're being manipulated. They encourage suppression of research about inner ways of knowing by discrediting discoveries about the psychic powers of humans and their relationship to the other dimensions, including non-physical advanced beings. Modern society seems, thus, to have reached an impasse between different epistemologies, in parentheses, ways of knowing, and between mutually exclusive cosmologies, that's theories of how the universe works. This impasse portends even deeper social divisions, conflicts that go beyond intellectual debate to a precipitous breakdown of civil society. Becoming more alienated intellectually and energetically, fearful groups on any side of the AB issue may begin to lash out at those holding views that undermine their own dogmas about what is, quote, natural or divine. I believe the process of a potential implosion of collective consciousness has already begun. The notion that humans are unique and alone in the universe is getting harder and harder to support. The crisis will arise if we do not consciously prepare ourselves when evidence of AB involvement in human affairs, indisputable even to most skeptics, when evidence becomes accepted by a critical mass of the public. Well, we know, don't we, folks, that acceptance by the critical mass seems to me are about ready to take a break. Acceptance by the critical mass doesn't mean that what the critical mass accepts is true, does it, folks? Because the religions that we've been given, we've been lied to a lot. He says, as public evidence for other life forms mounts, the issue of alien influence may become even more divisive than conflicts over race, immigration, religion, or abortion, with even more import for the future of humanity. I intuit that the key piece of evidence from a scientific discovery or the initiatives of another intelligent species, which makes our connections with other beings universally self-
I pledge allegiance to the King of Kings, and to his kingdom come, on earth as it is in heaven. One holy nation, under Heavenly Father, grace, mercy, justice for all.
Have you seen Loose Change, the best darn documentary produced in the 911 truth movement? Why waste your money keeping up the Jones, or getting stuck in plain sight when the best is free? You can find a link to download and watch the video, Loose Change, free, on the FirstAmendmentRadio.com homepage. If you don't do internet or can't download, just send $5 cash to cover shipping and handling to First Amendment Radio, 139 East Tulare Avenue, Tulare, T-U-L-A-R-E, California, 93274. 139 East Tulare Avenue, Tulare, T-U-L-A-R-E, California, 93274. And we will send you a copy of this must-see, must-share DVD, Loose Change, the best darn documentary produced in the 911 truth movement. Make sure you don't miss it, and tell everyone you know.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you?
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased. It has been stolen. There's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, and regular guest, world-renowned economist Robert Chapman, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, folks, I'm back here with you. I didn't hear the music for the break. I'm going to... Here, I'm going to read a couple of highlights I have before I move on. He says, from self-interest, the authorities cannot reveal evidence that suggests ABs of various types have always been involved in human affairs. They cannot afford to have people come to understand how their forebears used that direct intervention to cause the fragmentation of human consciousness. This fragmentation has made it possible for a few people to gain effective control over nation states and the profits from the labors of their citizens. The public that ignores this history cedes power to those who perpetuate the notion that, quote, divine institutions and materialistic consumerism represent the best we humans could have achieved. If I am correct about a possible overreaction, what can we expect to see? The tactic of divide and conquer has been the historical tool of groups who wish to control nations or empires. It can involve everything from formal wars to undeclared wars to terrorism, economic imperialism, cultural and religious conflicts, and fomenting class struggles. Possible forms of suppression can include greater censorship of scientific and professional channels, efforts to discredit alternative views, restricting free access to public media, and use of the criminal justice system to harass people. Continuing the Tower of Babel confusion of languages by manipulation of terms for ABs among disparate groups in society will impede efforts to compare the fragments of AB evidence. Another tactic that may be used to sow confusion is to treat anyone who reports contacts with other forms of consciousness as mentally ill. A third tactic marginalizes individuals who speak of their experience with ABs by relegating their stories to the tabloids and ostracizing them from mainstream conferences or other public forums. The groups in question will keep everyone too preoccupied with needless mayhem to be able to see the larger agenda, listen to this folks, control over the Earth's resources and manipulation of mass to maintain their self-arrogated power over human destiny. Folks, I'm going to be right with you. That was Alan phoning. I didn't want to let the phone keep beeping because it cuts out the voice. All right, now I am going to... He doesn't state anything as fact. That was one of the things I liked about this author. And I'm going to jump forward here. He really, it was very fascinating where he was using, or where he was talking about the different blood types, folks. He says, this is after the chapter where he's going back into the different cultures, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and he's comparing a lot of the books, the Old Testament, and etc. With the actual, that they're actual stories. And they're very much alike of gods who walked and talked with the people. He mentions Hinduism. He mentions the Japanese tradition, traditional societies of Africa, Europe, and the Americas. And this is quite interesting, but there's too many pages, so I don't want to read that. He says, combining the stories from all continents suggests that the advanced beings were more than abstract concepts of gods or characters in science fiction tales. They point to robust flesh and blood characters who descended to Earth from the heavens, exhibiting awesome powers and fully engaging humans. Numerous accounts indicate that humans walked and talked with the gods. In some cases, they were able to negotiate some of the conditions of their relationship. Not only did humans walk with the gods on terra firma, several reports indicate humans occasionally rode in shuttlecraft in the Earth's atmosphere. A few were even taken into deep space in larger ships. The Bible reports the prophet Ezekiel was taken aloft in a fiery chariot. And in Ezekiel chapter 8 describes a classical abduction experience. Noah and Enoch were also reported to have been taken into space. Anyway, he says, where does this leave us? The odds that descriptions of the God-human interactions in this chapter could have arisen accidentally in local tribes across widely separated regions of the world are minuscule. Several alternative explanations, parentheses, a pre-human world culture, a genetic basis for such vision, past life memories from another planet, mass delusions induced by environmental stress, God-implanted memories, also appear incredible and lack supporting evidence. Another explanation that at first glance appears equally incredible that such things actually happened is nonetheless supported by a cross-cultural content analysis of the myth. In the statistical logic used by most physical and social scientists, such a degree of congruence among apparently independent sources would indicate a high level of internal reliability. The corroborating evidence in the following chapters only strengthens the case for an A-B intervention. And then this chapter, were advanced beings involved in human origins? He goes into Atlantis, and then here's one heading, the how of human creation. It says traditional myths contain specific details that make their claims of A-B involvement in human origins seem credible, implying the involvement of pre-human species already existing on Earth. They include details that make sense to modern science in the current context of biological engineering. This possibility receives support from ancient Sumerian documents. The manipulation of proto-human ova, semen, and blood by the advanced beings, obliquely described in the Sumerian cuneiform text and elsewhere, is now feasible in genetic laboratories. Quetzalcoatl, from the Toltec and Aztec traditions, reportedly sprinkled his blood with the bones of earlier creatures to create humans. In the American West, the Salish tribe creator A.B. Amatkin used hair from his head to create the first five women. The Quinaults of the Pacific Northwest believe that their, quote, changer god, Kwati, created humans from his own sweat. All these methods could imply a contribution of the god's DNA. And these gods, as did the Anunnaki, came from the sky. The Chaco tribe from the Pampas in South America said that a female named Casagonaga, hanging from the sky, created humans. The Algonquins and the Blackfeet of North America say their gods, Tisi, Manitou, and Napi, respectively, made man from the earth with the breath of spirit. Similarly, the Old Norse traditions recorded in the Eddas report humans were created from two trees, ash for male and alder for female. That could also symbolize the tree of life or genetic knowledge. The Norse tradition, like the Hebrew, Kish, and Sumerian, had multiple gods. Was it a team of medical scientists? The first beings created by three Norse Germanic gods, Odin, Vili, and Ve, were refined in several steps before being placed in Middle Earth, where they became the progenitors of the human race. Remember Eve being made fertile in Eden? As in other legends, each god had different skills to contribute to the genetic engineering. They came through the sky from the home of the gods, quote, across the rainbow in Asgard. A Greek tale of Prometheus has advanced beings making man in the image of the gods by combining earth and water, i.e., combining existing mundane elements. The Toltecs portrayed the first woman in a garden, as in the Bible, with the serpent. And in parentheses, two snake figures form a double helix, the chemical structure of DNA. The Kish story includes four men from the sky being put to sleep to help make women creatures. And in parentheses, the Bible implies that Adam might have been caused to sleep while bone marrow was taken to create Eve. These accounts may imply the use of technology like anesthesia and gene splicing to create hybrids, as suggested by non-scientific Sumerian texts describing what the Anunnaki did. In his metaphysical readings regarding Atlantis, Edgar Cayce portrayed Atlantean humans as being seeded by the gods, a lower form of humans with more of an animal nature, which we might define as genetic cast-offs today, remained after the A-B, quote, seeding, S-E-E-D-I-N-G. Cayce said they served as beasts of burdens and even slaves for the more refined beings. He suggested the Indian caste of untouchables could perhaps be traced to this group of deformed and somewhat frightening hybrids. Later chapters in this book provide further details that reinforce the thesis in this chapter that some stage of humans, Homo sapiens, or at least Homo sapiens sapiens, did not just arise naturally, but were products of deliberate intervention. These advanced beings worked with earth material and or animals and somehow combined them with something of their own essence. As we've seen so far, the meaning of this essence varies from account to account. Some Sumerian and metaphysical materials track better than others with dated gaps in the fossil record and match several DNA phylogenetic trees prepared by genetic researchers to date Adam and Eve and human subspecies. So let's explore the details of human origins as seen through Sumerian eyes. And I'm going to skip over here. The book, again, if you're interested, folks, it really is quite fascinating. Excuse me. God's Genes and Consciousness. And the author is Paul Von Ward. And as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, I got the book mailed to me. This is Hampton Roads Publishing Company. I was just seeing if there was an address here. Oh, here's an 800 number. If you want to take it down, just in case you might like to be interested. 800-766-8009. I find it very fascinating. It talks about Yahweh in here, Yahweh, being one of the advanced beings. And then towards the end of the book, he relates how they make, after these beings left, and then they become supernatural. And I have said in the past that it seems that with the religious beliefs, people's minds have been split, because even the people who call themselves Judeo-Christians, that's an oxymoron. But when a person believes that every single word in the Bible is the divine word of God, inspired word of God, what they're saying is that our Creator is contradictory. That would scare the heck out of me if I really believed that. And I had a very dear person visit me from Canada, a minister, and this is when Chuck was here, and he was coming into the States, so he came by and spent an evening and spent the night and left the next day. We sat out on the porch that evening, and he told me that he came to save me and that he wasn't going to leave until I was saved. And we got talking about the different contradictions, you know, and, you know, loving your neighbor and doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, and Jehovah telling his people, well, you can't eat an animal that dies of itself, but you can sell it to the stranger at the gate. And that's the most unloving thing I could think of. Either that animal died of old age or it died of illness. And he saw that, I mean, as we talked about it. And I said, then do you see the contradiction? And what he said was no. See, that wasn't a contradiction, even though it was obviously a contradiction, because he said God can't contradict himself. And this is exactly what Paul Von Ward says in this book, that they've created a population of schizophrenics who believe in that two opposites are true. Okay. Introduction to Part 3. I talked way too much tonight because I'm not getting to what I really wanted to do. Maybe what I'll do another time is share with you the part where he's talking about the blood types. You know, Alan, when Alan was on originally with us, he really went into the different blood types. And this author's doing it too, and it was so fascinating. So fascinating. And maybe I just might do that. I just go right to that chapter now that I've, you know, done all this and talk. Introduction to Part 3. I've got this highlighted. He said the scientific method cannot definitely prove any particular hypothesis true or false unless it can control all the variables and forces relevant to the assumed cause and the observed effect. Unless it can control all the variables and forces relevant to the assumed cause and the observed effect. Given the complexity of our multi-dimensional universe, the most we can ask of the scientific method is to define the probability of a given hypothesis being correct. The probability of a given hypothesis being correct. The probability is a statistical calculation, itself based on assumptions about the nature of nature, of how many chances out of 100 or 1,000 the finding did not occur by chance, accident. However, given that humans, even with multidimensional senses, remain local incarnations of consciousness, we cannot aspire to better odds. Remember that even hypotheses based on intuition or psychic knowing still require testing of their reliability or validity in ordinary reality to be called truth. He is the one that made the statement that nature is the physical level of reality. The physical level of reality. This physical world is not real, because what is real, what Creator creates, is eternal. And that sounds stupid to say it isn't real, because we are here. Our consciousness is focused here, and so therefore it is very real to us. It is very real to me. But he said that nature is the physical level of reality, and that really was impactful for me. That our reverence, if you would, for nature, the awe of the beauty. Anyway, he said, therefore, we cannot expect to be able to prove with 100% certainty that at X date, A, B's, Y intervened or did not intervene in human history and had a positive or negative effect. The most we can hope for is corroboration, more evidence to support the hypothesis than evidence to counter it. If the preponderance of evidence were to prove A, B intervention was impossible, then we could give up the quest in this book. However, I believe you will agree that the existing evidence must compel any serious scientist to test the AB intervention theory. In this third part, we examine physical evidence related to the appearance and evolution of the genus Homo and its species Homo erectus. Homo sapiens, including Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons, and Homo sapiens sapiens, modern humans. Most of humanity's physical remains have been destroyed by biological, climatic, or geophysical processes, including the rotting caused by almost visible microbiological organisms. These conditions mean the assumptions that currently shape the conclusion of archaeologists, anthropologists, and geneticists rests on a limited database. You may find it very surprising that, even with these shortcomings, the tentative findings of these disciplines serve to corroborate the AB advanced being intervention hypotheses. And in this, as we've, oh shoot, we've got about 5 minutes to go here. He, in the beginning of this chapter 7, we're humans on a natural path. And this was, I'm going to have to probably give this up here because I won't be able to finish it, and then we'll just run out of time. But I guess I'll save this and read it to you. It isn't all that long, but I wouldn't be able to read it in 5 minutes. Actually, I've got about 3 to go. The book, again, that I've been reading from is God's Genes and Consciousness, folks. And I'll give you that 800 number again if you're interested. In case you're interested in taking a look, it's 800-766-8009. This is directly from the publisher. Oh, here's his. Oh. Let's see, Hampton Roads Publishing Company. There's another phone number here, but it's not an 800 number, so I won't give you that. I'll be back with you tomorrow night, and Darren will be back with you Monday, barring any unseen events, of course, unforeseen events. I've enjoyed this tonight, folks. It's been a long time since we just, you and I were together. And when I was on the shortwave, actually, I did probably the majority of the broadcast, just to our listeners, and had occasional guests. Somebody asked me how long Alan has been a regular guest, and I'll tell you when it happened. It was last fall when I was canning, and that's when Darren asked me if I would take Wednesday night because he has to work. And I'm telling you, I canned for a month and a half, apples and pears. It was a real time-consuming thing. So I would call Alan and say, hey, do you want to come on with me? And because, of course, there's no preparation necessary when Alan and I do the broadcast together. Then I got into a cleaning mode, and I was cleaning this house for a month and a half, right from top to bottom. And it just, that's how this happened. Alan hasn't always been the only guest I've ever had, for those of you who are new listeners, and because people are curious, and so I wanted to share that with you. I don't know if my clock here is right on or not. Oh, here's another thing I wanted to tell you. I got a call from Bob Peters last night. I guess that he tried to go into firstamendmentradio.com, and it wasn't available again. As you know, last Wednesday, our website was down. I couldn't even get through on my phone lines. But if you can't get through on firstamendmentradio.com, go to firstamendmentradio.net. That's kind of evidently a back door. And last night after I talked with Bob, I went in to Sweet Liberty, and I was able to click right over. So it's hard to say what's going on. And for whatever reason tonight, I'm not hearing the music. And so I think we're out of time, folks. And if I say goodnight just a few seconds early, it's all right. Thank you for being here. I'll be back with you tomorrow night. Hope you have a lovely evening. I hope you have sweet dreams tonight. And I will see you tomorrow. Have a nice day tomorrow. God bless you all. Good night, folks.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-7000.